This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll learn about challenges rural doctors face during COVID-19, such as convincing patients to get vaccinated. Becoming a nurse isn't easy, but it's especially difficult getting the on-the-job training during a pandemic. That story's on the way. And we'll hear about a new documentary exploring the life and death of a young Chinese student murdered after her abduction from the University of Illinois. The filmmaker is a young woman herself who worked closely with the family of Yingying Zhang.
They really wanted to get their story out, and really wanted the audience and just the general public to memorize Yingying as a very young, bright, and talented woman, and really to see, you know, what kind of hardship they've been going through in the past 3 years.
More on the film Finding Yingying. Stay with us on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, a documentary looks at the life and death of a Chinese student at the University of Illinois, murdered in 2017. Also, we visit a Mississippi River community to see how it's recovered after a major flood, and nursing students thrown on the front lines of the fight against the pandemic. That and more coming up on Statewide. Family doctors in rural parts of Illinois often have to do some education when it comes to COVID-19. That's because, as research shows, many rural residents trust their family doctor more than public health officials to give them unbiased healthcare information. But these doctors face a major hurdle. Surveys also show rural residents make up one of the largest groups of vaccine-hesitant Americans. Mariah Wolfel has more.
Dr. Jeff Ripperda has been posting on social media a lot more since the pandemic began.
A couple of posts I've created have gone sort of viral, which is weird for me.
Ripperda is a family doctor at a clinic in Murfreesboro, a town of about 8,000 in central Illinois. He's been using Facebook to try to convince people that taking the vaccine is safe. And he thinks it could work because people in the community trust him.
Being a small-town doctor, it's kind of hard to not have a close relationship with patients because these are community members. These are people whose kids and my kids go to school together, people who I see around town, people who I socialize with.
But Ripperda hasn't been able to get through to everyone, and rural doctors like him are facing some major barriers in trying to increase vaccine literacy. More than suburban or urban doctors, rural doctors are contending with high rates of skepticism, even among leaders in their community. Dr. Joey Jackson works at a rural clinic in El Dorado, about 30 minutes from Kentucky.
We're Bible Belt down here, and there have been some ministers who have been preaching from the pulpit, just an anti-science rhetoric, you know, much like a political figure, you know, that they've got people who trust them to be saying the right things.
Ashley Kurzinger is with the healthcare policy and research group, the Kaiser Family Foundation, and she's been studying hesitancy rates.
For many Republican and rural residents, they think the risks of COVID-19 are being exaggerated. So that is one reason why they don't feel compelled to be getting the vaccine.
She's co-author of a recent study that shows 35% of rural residents say they definitely will not or probably won't get a vaccine when it's available. That's compared to 25% overall.
In addition, large shares of rural residents think that getting vaccinated is a personal choice rather than something that they should do to benefit their communities.
The survey also shows proximity to COVID-19 is not a factor. Even people who know someone who's contracted or died from the virus, they don't want a vaccine. In Illinois, average positivity rates in some rural counties hover in the teens, hitting nearly 30% at times in the past month. Still, many don't believe COVID is all it's cracked up to be.
I don't feel this virus warrants a rushed vaccine. I kind of feel that's what we have an immune system for.
This is a 48-year-old resident of Streeter, about 100 miles southwest of Chicago. He asked WBEZ not to use his name, fearing he'd face ridicule for choosing not to take a COVID-19 vaccine.
I just think it's pretty much another flu bug.
Is there a point when you would feel comfortable getting a vaccine?
Maybe about 10 years from now, if people aren't having a bunch of side effects.
Okay, so
I probably wouldn't even do it then.
The Kaiser Family Foundation shows a conversation with a family doctor could potentially put people worried about long-term side effects at ease. That's because rural residents overwhelmingly say they trust their doctor to give accurate information about a COVID-19 vaccine. But it's not clear that people opposed to the shot will seek that information out, and doctors can only do so much. Dr. Jackson from El Dorado says he'd answer questions about the vaccine all day long, but it's tiring trying to engage with deeply skeptical people day in and day out.
You know, that's been pretty dark at times because it's like, well, who am I trying to say? I'm trying to say people who think I'm a fraud, you know, and that's been tough. But at the same time, you know, I think it's important that you know, you rise to the occasion.
And Dr. Ripperdoff from Murfreesboro says there are trade-offs to being outspoken about the vaccine.
You know, when the healthcare community is so enthusiastically supportive of the vaccine, it can also be a little bit of a put-off for people who are a little more skeptical and probably make them a little less likely to have the necessary conversation.
He suspects people who've made up their mind about the vaccine aren't calling their doctors to talk about it. In Streeter, the vaccine-hesitant man who says he does have a family doctor he trusts to talk about the vaccine with doesn't plan on doing so.
That's Mariah Wolfel with that story. If you looked up the top searched careers on Google in 2020, how to become a nurse was one of them. Applications for nursing schools are up too. Peter Medlin from WNIJ has more on what the last year has been like for the people pursuing a career in nursing during the pandemic.
Back in March of 2020, Taylor Bolte was finishing up her nursing clinical shift when the hospital told her she wasn't allowed to come back. Not just her, all nursing students had their clinicals cut short as COVID-19 spread across the country.
Clearly the hospitals weren't prepared and we weren't really expecting for COVID to have this impact, and it just kind of came all quickly. But I don't really remember there being like this huge panic beforehand. I think it all just kind of came at once.
The students had to leave for liability reasons, but also because hospitals were running out of PPE. They didn't have enough masks or gowns to support more staff with COVID patients coming in. Around the same time, Bolte's nursing classes at Lewis University went remote. Nursing is about as hands-on of a profession as it gets, so the coursework had to shift dramatically. Dr. Julia Koklas is a nurse practitioner and chair of the nursing department at Lewis University. She says students got to work in telehealth, and they tried to utilize new technology to make the experience as practical as possible.
There are programs like iHuman where they can virtually do physical exams on patients.
Bolte says the software allows students to evaluate cases and develop the judgment skills they need in the hospital. Some students, especially in the nurse practitioner program, are seeing their progress delayed because they haven't been able to meet the direct patient care requirements. Through the summer and early fall, many Lewis students, including Bolte, were able to go back for their clinicals. Kokla says they focused on students who didn't get much of an opportunity before the pandemic so they could have some on-the-ground experience. Bolte says when she returned, the atmosphere of the hospital was palpably different than before the pandemic.
I wasn't working on COVID floors, but I did have an ICU rotation. So all of those nurses had taken care of COVID patients like in the heat of the pandemic and even now. And they're just worn out.
They're working 80-hour weeks, in some cases living in a hotel room. Bolte says it's been a trial by fire of whether you're cut out for the career. She says she's seen every side of the experience.
We're in a position where we're going to see a lot of people being saved and getting better. So that's kind of hopeful in the midst of it. What kind of shocked me was when I was like working with nurses that had been working with COVID patients, is there was almost kind of this like immunity to people dying because they saw it all the time.
So how do you train nursing students to cope with that, especially when they can't just take off their gear and hug after a tough day? Bolte says she's even heard of nurses getting COVID in the break room the moment they let their guard down. Even if it's digitally, Kokla says they found time to let students debrief with each other about their concerns, the joy and the pain that comes with the territory. Bolte says they've had plenty of professional development classes talking about end-of-life care and how to communicate with patients and their families. During the pandemic, it's also forced them to figure out how to get family members on FaceTime or calls when COVID patients are dying alone. Kokla says it's a harsh reality, but it's what nurses need to be able to do.
It's a service job. It's a commitment to caring for people in their most vulnerable time. And I think that this pandemic has really opened everyone's eyes to what this calling truly is.
Bolte was living on campus during her clinicals in the fall and wasn't seeing her family. She says just being on a college campus is risk enough. She graduated in December and is starting full-time soon at Swedish American Hospital in Rockford. She also just got her second dose of the vaccine, which she said felt like quite a relief after 2020.
And I had COVID too, so I should be an antibody machine by now.
While telehealth and software like iHuman help make nursing education more flexible, Koklas isn't sure how the pandemic will alter her courses after it's over. There will be more students, though. Lewis's graduate program numbers have skyrocketed. The vaccine provides more than a glimmer of hope, but the United States just set another record for COVID-19 deaths last week. More than 22,000 Americans lost their lives. Bolte says nurses can't escape from COVID-19. It's a threat at work, a threat at home, and everywhere in between. Even so, she says she feels ready to strap on her N95 mask and get to work. I'm Peter Medlin.
The Illinois State Board of Education is concerned that likely new high school graduation requirements will be too burdensome for some districts. And as Derek Cantu reports, the new course requirements were part of an equity package pushed through by the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus this month.
Over the next few years, three new courses will be required in Illinois schools: laboratory science, computer science, and foreign language. Certain ISBE board members, including Susie Morrison, believe Illinois' longstanding teacher shortage could get in the way of mandating the new course offerings.
I think maybe it's time that we as a board take a look at our current high school graduation requirements, because we just keep adding on and adding on.
Morrison also says ISBE has continually advocated for the importance of career and technical education, but that a push towards requiring, for example, 2 years of foreign language could complicate that goal. I'm Derek Cantu.
Illinois is known as the Prairie State, but it's lost over 99% of its native prairie. The state gives land that maintains a substantial degree of its natural character its highest level of protection, and those are known as Illinois Nature Preserves. But much of the land is in danger of being lost to invasive species. Jerome McDonald reports on a new group, Friends of the Illinois Nature Preserves, that aims to give these areas the attention they deserve.
I'm at Deer Grove Forest Preserve in Palatine. It's an Illinois nature preserve, and I'm going to ask the people here if they know what an Illinois nature preserve is.
I do not.
Yeah, don't have much of a knowledge.
Not much officially, but I've grown up, I'm really close to the Grove and in Glenview, and I've gone there frequently my whole life.
Like a forest?
Like a forest, but like, is this one of them?
Yes, it is. This is an Illinois nature preserve.
Illinois nature preserves are land that's so valuable to our natural heritage that it's protected in perpetuity. Illinois was the first state to offer nature such a high level of protection. Here's the exciting part. They can be anywhere. On private land, owned by land conservation groups, park districts. My old high school, Glenbrook North, has an acre and a half remnant prairie that's an Illinois nature preserve. But the bulk of nature preserves are where you'd expect them. Half the acreage is in state parks. When the state started designating this land in the 1960s, just grabbing land was considered conservation. Now there's almost 600 nature preserves.
Through the mid-1900s, we practiced what's been called fortress conservation, where we acquire land and put a metaphorical fence around it, just protect it from external threats, and we've done our job. You check the box, that place is conserved forever.
That's John Rogner from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. They oversee the nature preserves. Rogner says, now we know that type of conservation is not enough.
My Lord, now we have to manage all of this or it's going to decline and we're going to lose them anyway. So that's where we are right now.
Invasives have come along. They're everywhere and there's a malignancy for every situation. Left unchecked, buckthorn or honeysuckle become the understory of the forest. Phragmites, with its tall feather duster tops, dominates our wetlands. The spiky oval seed heads of teasel sit on top of hundreds of stalks in your sunny areas, and there's lots of others. Stephen Packard is a fixture in the conservation movement. He's been worried for decades about malignant species. He helped start landmark volunteer restoration efforts to turn things around in the Chicago area in the late 70s. But there's still work to be done. So Packard's part of a new stewardship group, Friends of the Illinois Nature Preserves. They aim to bring restoration help to the surprising number of nature preserves that need it.
Nature preserves are like churches. They need a congregation. They just, it's complicated and demanding enough and rewarding, fulfilling enough to the people who do it that you could have one everywhere, like Little League or the local Audubon Society.
I went to the Friends of the Illinois Nature Preserve's kickoff event in March. It was at Goose Lake Prairie near Morris. There were a couple of acres of high-quality prairie remnant that needed attention. Eriko Kojima is a veteran steward who's using a roller and a bucket of plant poison to apply the finishing touches to some invasives.
See those stumps there? These volunteers just cut all the gray dogwood that was in there, and we've been painting them with this herbicide that kills the woody stems, and hopefully that stand of dogwood in there will never come back now.
Later that day, volunteers gathered by the Friends group collaborated with the Department of Natural Resources on a burn at Goose Lake. They tipped the scales at Goose Lake's 2 acres of high-quality prairie in just one day. But there's a lot more of Goose Lake that needs attention, where there's over 1,500 acres of Illinois Nature Preserve. Here's Stephen Packard, who's been helping form these groups for decades.
Starting a stewardship group is sort of like learning to drive a car or change a baby. It's not rocket science, but you don't do it right without anybody helping you learn how to do it.
Friends of the Illinois Nature Preserves will mix its restoration experts with local teams of volunteers. After they learn the ropes of stewardship, local people will lead the groups. I tagged along with the Friends for a day of brush cutting near Kankakee. There was already a bonfire of invasive honeysuckle when I got there. The 20-acre Langham Island is in the Kankakee River and is part of Kankakee River State Park. It's a special place. Langham Island is the only place in the world where a particular mallow grows, now known as the Kankakee mallow. Steve Bowen and Karen Horn live right next door to the state park in the town of Altorf. They had a great time volunteering.
We're just complete amateurs, and we cut what they tell us to cut. And we believe in biodiversity, and we believe in restoration.
Really awesome watching the island open up. And I'm looking forward to seeing when more of the native plants are available and able to grow in their natural habitat.
That's all part of the plan for Emma Levins, who runs the Friends program in Kankakee.
What we're trying to foster is like a culture and practice of participation, and that will require a lot of people, but mostly it will require people who care.
The Illinois Department of Natural Resources, which oversees the nature preserves, says it's a critical program, and they've brought new energy too by naming the first new executive director of the nature preserves in 4 years. Jerome McDonald, WBEZ News.
Stay with us. We have more to come on Statewide. We'll find out how a Mississippi River town is recovering from a big flood. A reminder, you can find links to the stories you hear each week at our website at statewideshow.com. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. And coming up, how a teacher's videos for students went viral. That and more still ahead. Scientists say climate change is already here, and it's causing more frequent storms and flooding. Lesha Bushak traveled to Grafton, where the Illinois and Mississippi rivers come together, to see how that town is still dealing with the physical and mental health effects of a devastating flood in 2019.
On a sunny autumn day, waves calmly lap on the bank of the Mississippi River in Grafton, a southwestern Illinois town of 650 people. It's a far cry from the spring of 2019, when snow, rain, and remnants of a tropical storm caused the Mississippi River to overrun its banks. 8-foot-high floodwaters rose to the roofs of homes and businesses downtown, forcing residents and business owners to evacuate. Grafton Mayor Rick Eberlin remembers how high the water reached the city's lighthouse.
The water was over the Port of Grafton sign and almost to the very top of this roof line. It was very traumatic. It was very unnerving, I guess you could say. This flood lasted for 125 days, so it's the longest flood that this region has ever experienced.
The damage wasn't limited to homes and roads. It also took a toll on mental health.
It was such an emotional time to see the looks on people's faces every time, you know, rain was in the forecast, or every time, you know, you're out working and you'd hear thunder. I can remember seeing a business owner, pretty tough guy, never saw a whole lot of emotion out of that individual, just break down.
Research shows that natural disasters are linked to mental illness like post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, anxiety, and depression. Dr. Ted Bender is a psychologist and president of Unity Point Health in Peoria.
The more and more of these types of events that happen, the more and more people are going to be exposed to pain and threat. And the more and more people that get exposed to pain and threat, the more people will develop mental health disorders that need to be treated.
But support for those mental health issues is often lacking in the aftermath of disasters. A recent survey out of the Center for Public Integrity and Columbia Journalism Investigations found that among U.S. regions hit hard by wildfires, hurricanes, or floods, 70% of survivors reported not receiving mental health services in the aftermath of the disaster. Grafton received a FEMA disaster declaration in the fall of 2019, but it did not receive any aid for mental health services. Dan Bechtel saws through large slabs of wood at his furniture store, which saw 7 feet of water when the floods hit last year. He says the stress of having to face another flood weighs heavily on him.
Just the anguish of coming back in, cleaning up, starting over. No, it is a very much of a mental strain because you're worried about your livelihood being gone. And at this age, I don't want to start over. I'm too old to start over.
Oliver Reedy has lived in Grafton his entire life of 81 years. He's noticed the flooding in Grafton getting worse over time, and he believes it's due to climate change.
There's got to be some changes coming. Some people may not think so, but there is. And if they don't watch what they're doing in the next 30 years, I'm afraid there won't be much of it left.
Colin Wellenkamp, executive director with Mississippi River Cities and Towns, says those disasters are indeed increasing over time.
It used to be that these events were spaced out 25 to 30 years. You know, you'd have a major event every couple of decades. Now we have a major event that breaks records the next year.
He says massive natural disasters along the Mississippi River have accumulated in recent years, placing a greater strain on mental health.
Emphasizing intervention and prevention for the impacts of mental illness and emotional support are absolutely necessary, and we definitely need to ramp that up.
Slowly, with the help of funds from FEMA, Grafton is rebuilding. While they're waiting on more mental health care in the region, the residents in the meantime have to rely on their own resilience. I'm Lesha Bushak, Illinois Newsroom.
A group of U.S. senators is pushing the new Biden-Harris administration to restore the renewable fuel standard. The RFS program is aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions by requiring oil refineries to blend in a minimum volume of biofuels. Under the Trump administration, oil refineries were granted numerous waivers for meeting that requirement, and critics argue the waivers ultimately hurt American corn farmers who rely on the ethanol industry. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois led the group of senators writing a letter to President Biden emphasizing the importance of the fuel standard to producers across the region. Dana Cronin spoke with Senator Duckworth about that letter, and she started by asking what exactly she wants to see change in the new administration.
Time and again, the Trump administration worked very hard to undermine the RFS, and they really hurt our farmers only to help big oil companies and go against everything that our RFS stands for. So what I want to make sure is to make sure that the EPA, for example, rejects any future petitions for the small refinery exemptions that do not meet the necessary standards. I want the EPA to very quickly publish renewable volume obligations so we know exactly what the ethanol volume obligation needs to be and so that we can stick to it. And then I also want them to approve the pending applications that are in right now already for corn kernel fiber ethanol, and then update their biofuel emissions modeling to allow these fuels to be commercialized. And then, of course, we need to make sure that we include biofuels in our commitment to the Paris Accord.
And why is it important to you that President Biden address that issue so early on in his term?
Well, because I need to make it clear, and we need to have that commitment to our agricultural sector that we are going to stick with biofuels. I mean, bottom line, we can't get to a carbon neutral future without biofuels. We just simply can't get there. You can't get there just on solar. You can't get there just on wind. You can't get there on any single fuel source. And biofuels are a critical part of that. And by the way, biofuels are purely American, right? It's American grown, American produced. And so it's not something that we're relying for, oil from outside of the United States. And so I think it's really important that biofuels are part of that catalog of fuels that are going to get us through that carbon neutral future. And of course, it's going to support our ag sector, which is vital, vital for our national security. I think people think of ag and they just think of food, right? But what I tell people is ag is national security. Ag is just as important for our national security as our tanks and guns and helicopters. A nation that can't feed itself is not a nation that can lead the free world. And so we need to make sure that we maintain our commitment to ag. And one of the ways to do that is to allow them to do what they do best, which is be very, very inventive, be very, very productive, and work on and support biofuels, because it's one of the ways that ag can actually produce and support our country.
I'm curious, Senator Duckworth, how do you see agriculture policy more broadly changing under this new Biden-Harris administration?
I think you're going to see a real support for family farms and small farms. I think you're going to see continued support for investments in bringing people back to ag, at the same time as a commitment that you can count on for biofuels, so that you're not, it's not a year to year grant, not a year to year tax waiver, that you're going to know for the next 5 years or for the next 10 years, we're going to make a commitment to biofuels and it's going to be there. And you can plan on it and you can make your capital investments necessary for you to be able to grow your operation to produce the necessary biofuels.
That's U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. She spoke with reporter Dana Cronin. Federal financial aid to people in prison was quietly restored as part of a COVID-19 stimulus measure passed by Congress last month. The U.S. Department of Education has until 2023 to reinstate Pell Grant access to people in prison, which was previously banned under the 1994 crime bill. The grants are awarded to low-income undergrads. Education reporter Lee Gaines spoke with Margaret DeZeriga of the Vera Institute of Justice about how an Obama-era program called Second Chance Pell paved the way for this reform and what it could mean for prison education moving forward.
When Second Chance Pell was announced in 2015, this was the first time that we were nearing the possibility of really bringing Pell grants back into prison environments. And in 2016, 67 colleges were selected by the U.S. Department of Education, and they were allowed to administer Pell Grants for the first time since 1994. Then we had a change in administration, and Second Chance Pell continued to receive a lot of support from the Trump administration. So we now have 130 colleges across most all states that are teaching in prison and able to access students' Pell eligibility to cover the cost of their tuition. The incarcerated students since the start of Second Chance Pell in 2016 had earned more than 4,500 bachelor's degrees, associate's degrees, post-secondary diplomas, and certificates. The fact that we had, thousands of students enrolled in college really contributed to the political momentum. So through this big budget package that included COVID relief and many other things, the ban on Pell Grant access for people in prison was lifted, which was a very, very significant achievement.
So I'm curious how the reinstatement of Pell Grants will affect colleges already operating prison education programs and whether you think it will incentivize more institutions to get involved in that type of programming.
We know that for both rounds of Second Chance Pell, nearly 200 colleges applied. And so that suggests there was a lot greater demand than the number of colleges that were selected for teaching in prison. So this could create opportunities for those colleges that wanted to teach in prison, but were not selected for Second Chance Pell. And I think that the fact that Pell reinstatement would give colleges a reliable way of envisioning how students are paying for tuition, I think that'll allow colleges to chart a real path for either expanding current programming or for new colleges to come in.
The benefits of reinstating Pell Grants are pretty clear for both incarcerated people and the colleges teaching them. But what do you think are the benefits to the broader society?
So we know that expanding access to post-secondary education in prison provides incarcerated people with greater opportunity when they return to their families and their communities. It helps cut state spending on prisons, given the connection between post-secondary education programs and reduced recidivism. And it can really be a catalyst in transforming the lives of students and their families. Many people I've spoken with who talk about getting their college education while they're incarcerated and the conversations they're having with their children or their other family members, encouraging them to pursue college, helping, you know, shift some of the messages they may have been told as high school kids, even about whether they were quote unquote college material, and sharing with their family members and their children that they are college material and they should pursue this if that's what they want to do, and here's how you do it. You know, we know that Black and Brown people are disproportionately harmed by the criminal justice system. And so lifting this ban on Pell Grant access is a way to, you know, address some of those inequities and obstacles to successful reentry. So we also see Pell reinstatement as a step toward racial equity.
Margaret DeZeriga speaking with education reporter Lee Gaines about the reinstatement of Pell Grants to people in prison. A Davenport, Iowa physical education teacher has started making videos to keep his students active during quarantine, and now he's gone viral internationally. Mariana Bacchiao has more.
10 seconds for each exercise. Not that bad, okay? So you're building yourself up this entire time. So you're going to work through it, and you're going to build up your endurance on all these exercises. I hope you enjoy it. Looks like fun. I had a lot of fun putting it together. Let's play.
That's Mick Seifert, the PE teacher at Madison Elementary School. He started making exercise videos back in March when the pandemic shut down schools. Now his YouTube channel, PE with Mr. S, has nearly 3,000 subscribers.
This year, we went for spring break, and we got notification that we weren't going to return. So after I went through that initial shock and self-pity, I realized that my students and their families are going to be facing some very challenging situations. And I knew I needed to up my game, so to speak, and find ways to engage students through new technology.
Then this December, Seifert posted a Christmas-themed exercise challenge.
This is called On the First Day of Fitness December Gave to Me. Yeah, that might sound a little bit familiar. And that's because it's based off the song a little bit. So if you notice, every single day on this calendar for December, there's a different GIF or an exercise of what you have to do that day.
It wasn't long after he posted the video that the views spiked to over 45,000, and educators from overseas started calling. Seifert woke one morning to a voicemail from an Italian PE teacher in charge of international affairs.
And she reached out to me because she had shown my video in one of their webinars, and a lot of the PE teachers really enjoyed it. So she reached out to me and asked me if she could have, I guess, the video. So I sent her the video, and she translated it into an Italian version.
Seifert says his videos are a family affair. His son, a student at St. Ambrose University, composes the music for his videos. His wife is a personal trainer, so she helps with the content of each video. And his daughter stars as Cinderella.
I have a favorite video, and it's called Wheel of Fitness. And that one's my favorite, my personal favorite, because it has my daughter in it. I have my daughter is a student with an IEP, and she has Down syndrome. And so she's in it, and she's wearing her Cinderella dress the whole time, participating, doing an amazing job with demonstrating. My son is also in it as well, and he's been very helpful because I didn't know how to do any, I mean, from Google, I didn't know how to do any of this at all. I can't stress that enough. I did not know how to do any of this. So I'm learning so many different things, and I've grown so much as an educator. But my son, he had a YouTube channel because he creates his own music. So he had to show me how to do YouTube, and at first I imagine it was kind of a pain in the tail.
Seifert's students assume he's rich now, but while Seifert hasn't made any money off of his videos, their popularity speaks to how schools around the globe are navigating the pandemic.
Obviously, you want to stay healthy, and you know, I'm guilty of it as well. I'm used to a routine, you know, especially as a PE teacher. You know, when I get home, I usually have between 15 to 20,000 steps in just a regular day. I mean, just when I get home. And suddenly, you know, when I'm quarantined and I'm stuck in my house, at times I would have to, you know, find ways to move my body, because, you know, suddenly my 15 to 20,000 steps would turn into 6 to 8,000 steps. And that's a big adjustment, and you can feel it. You can feel it in your body. You can just feel it. I mean, that sedentary lifestyle, it's, you, if you're used to moving, you have to move. So you have to find different ways to train your body to get used to a routine. You know, I have to get out and walk in the morning. I have to do this. And it's just about forming habits and, you know, taking care of your body.
Seifert says he plans to continue making videos even after the pandemic is over. I'm Mariana Bacayao.
This is Statewide, and there's more to come. Stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A controversial former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court has died. James Heipel passed away in a Peoria hospital this week at the age of 87. Heipel wrote a unanimous court opinion in what became known as the Baby Richard case. The biological father of a 3-year-old boy sued for custody after learning the mother put the child up for adoption without his knowledge. That decision resulted in the boy being taken away from his adoptive parents, with the moment captured on camera. The child cried and reached out for the only mother he knew. Heipel was blasted in both the press and political circles, but in a 1999 interview with Public Radio, he maintained the law was clear.
You might pick up a child out of a grocery cart at the supermarket that doesn't belong to you, take the child home, keep the child for 2 or 3 years, you may have a wonderful home. That doesn't give you a right to keep the child. You're not the parent, and you had no right to deprive the parent of the child.
Heipel faced other scrutiny, including an allegation he tried to use his position to avoid traffic tickets. He was censured in 1997 and resigned as Chief Justice, but he finished his term on the court in 2000. Yingying Zhang came to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2017 with big dreams and aspirations. But within weeks of arriving on the campus, the visiting Chinese PhD student went missing. Zhang was last seen on June 9th of 2017 getting into a car that belonged to Brent Christensen, a former PhD student who 2 years later confessed to kidnapping and murdering her. The two did not previously know each other. The news made headlines in both the U.S. and around the world, causing a shakeup in the Chinese international student community at the university and abroad. Northwestern University journalism graduate student Jenny Shi felt like two important stories were missing from the headlines: who Zhang was and her family's journey in seeking answers about her disappearance and death. She ended up spending the next few years filming their story. She joined Susie Yan to talk about the process of making the documentary Finding Yingying.
This is your first feature documentary, and I have to say it was such an intimate and personal look. Why did you want to tell the story, and how did you want to tell it?
Yeah, so when Yingying first went missing in the summer of 2017, I was still a student at Northwestern University. And the fact that she was a Chinese international student, and I later found out she actually went to the same university in China with me, that really, you know, stuck with me. And I wanted to figure out what happened to her. So after Ying's family arrived here, I went to visit the family and first work as a volunteer. The more time I spent with them, I just realized how amazing Ying was. And her story and her family story got really lost in the media attention when they are really crazy on the crime and investigation. So for me, a story about Yingying is really important to me, and that's why I wanted to tell her story.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned her family and her friends. Who was Yingying to her family and friends and to those who knew her?
Yeah, so to her family, especially her parents, basically Yingying, she was the center of the family. She was such a strong bond, and actually, you know, she's the strength that put the family together. There were like some conflicts happened in the family between the parents and also between the parents and the Ying's brother, but she was always so mature and always so caring and thinking about her family. And she actually was the first person in her whole family who went to college and eventually got a chance to pursue a PhD degree in the US. And she wanted to support her family after she graduated and went back to China to be a teacher. And for her friends, she was also a very amazing person, that she always had smiles on her face. Mm-hmm. And she would basically, you know, send postcards, birthday greetings, wishes to all her friends. And in the film, we actually showed a lot of her handwritings, not only her diaries, but also her postcard. So you could really tell her personality from all these, you know, stuff of her like own writings. So she was basically just very amazing and impressed. Yeah.
Yeah, a very bright light in a lot of people's lives. You narrate the film and provide commentary for viewers and reading Ying's diary entries aloud. And you even draw parallels between her life and your own. Here's a bit of the film. Let's take a listen.
April the 30th, 2017. I've been in Illinois for a week. University of Illinois is very beautiful. Kind of like Sun Yat-sen University. I fell in love with it at first glance. However, I'm feeling a little anxious. It's the first time I've lived in an apartment alone. It's the first time I've lived independently. I feel a little bit lonely, but I still want to try. Pursuing a PhD requires a lot of hard work. The rule is simple. Live a simple life. Be effective.
What more did you learn about Ying Ying by reading her diary, and what was it like to be part of the documentary in this way?
Yeah, sure. So we didn't know the existence of diaries until 2 months after Ying's family, after she disappeared. And it was at a press conference where they updated the recent events or incidents happening. So Ying's boyfriend, he actually read the last line of her last diary entry of Ying Ying wrote before she disappeared. And it was, life is too short to be ordinary. I think before that, all I learned about Ying Ying was basically through her friends, colleagues, and they were describing her, you know, like, you know, someone. But it was totally different when I first saw her diaries. So her ambitions, so why she wanted to come to the U.S. to pursue a PhD degree. And also, I saw a lot of, like, she was actually really vulnerable, you know, meanwhile, even though she was ambitious, determined about, like, what she wanted to achieve in the U.S., you really saw the vulnerability. And for me, that's something I had exactly when I came here as an international student. And that really made me think about, you know, what the film should really be about and how I'm going to put everything together. Mm-hmm. So that came to the idea of using the diary as a very important element of the film throughout the film to bring her to life. And I myself, as someone kind of having like parallel experience as an international student, just like Ying Ying, I just feel it's very important to include my perspective in the film. Also, like my own connection with Ying's parents. At first, I was thinking, you know, I'm just going to document everything. But later on, actually, I just wasn't able to really separate my role as a filmmaker. Yeah. And also as a family, friends, and a volunteer. So there were a lot of like details and also a very intimate conversation that the family would only have with me individually. And these are, I think, great details to also like show how important Ying Ying was to them.
Yeah.
And that's why I decided like me reading Ying's diary and also putting my own experience and my own feelings into the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we've mentioned, this film is very intimate. You get some really personal looks into the family's journey here. And we see things unravel in real time, from moments of sorrow and hope to tension building within the family. I mean, there was a fight between the parents. How did you navigate the emotional and ethical boundaries of making this documentary?
That was really challenging to me. And me as a first-time filmmaker, I started this project when I was still in school. So I had a lot of questions about, you know, all the ethical dilemmas. And I've been questioning myself all the time whether I'm really, you know, exploring my relationship with the family and filming probably the worst moments in their life in front of camera. And I actually had a lot of conversation with experienced filmmakers, including Gordon Quinn, who is the artistic director and co-founder of Cartoon Quinn Films. Mm-hmm. He gave me a lot of guidance about how to navigate those situations. And from my perspective, when I was filming with Ying's parents, and I have another cinematographer, also the co-producer of the film, his name is Shiling Sun. He's actually a student at U of I at the time, and he was already a volunteer before I started filming. Mm-hmm. So we kind of worked together. And I would say, like, at first, 70% of the time we spent with the family was without camera, because we just really want to show our respect to them. And somehow we still wanted to help them as volunteers. Mm-hmm. And whenever we wanted to film the family, we would ask them, you know, whether it's okay to film. And we would double check with them after, like, each shoot to see, you know, whether it was okay to do that. Sometimes I would say, like, Ying's parents, they were just so nice and they didn't want to say no to other people. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to make sure everyone was on the same page and have a smooth conversation. Mm-hmm. And that really helped us a lot, yeah, in the past 3 years, basically filming with the family.
Yeah. That's Jenny Shi, director of the award-winning film Finding Ying Ying. The film follows Ying Ying's family's journey in unraveling the mystery around her disappearance and finding justice for her death. Now, before releasing the film to the public, you showed it to Ying Ying's family first. How did they respond?
Yeah. So, again, it was a little bit challenging for us to show them and how to show them. We didn't want to throw a link to them, since they are in China right now. And I'm in the U.S. Because of COVID, I just couldn't travel. So I ended up finding the two of my friends in China. They traveled to Ying's parents' home and show the film on their laptop. And my co-producer and the cinematographer, Shilin, and I, we Skype in. So we just want to create a sense of, like, we are actually with them watching the film, going through this journey together. We were a little bit, like, nervous when, mm-hmm, before we showed them. We have several concerns. One is because there were a lot of emotional moments in the film, I don't know how the family, they are going to deal with this. And the second one is, like, the fight scene you just mentioned. Yeah. In Chinese culture, we didn't really want to show family conflicts in public. But actually, to our surprise, I mean, it was difficult, you know, for them to watch. And Ying's mom, she couldn't stop, like, crying when the, yeah, film first started. But my friend, she was hugging her, like, all the time. And to Ying's father, he was actually, like, quite calm throughout the whole process. And I actually, after watching the film, I asked them about if there's anything they had concern. They were okay with, like, the family fight, all things like that, mm-hmm, because they thought, you know, that's just what happened. You know, yeah, that's the reality. And for them, they really wanted to get their story out, and they really wanted the audience and just the general public to memorize Ying Ying, yeah, as a very young, bright, and talented woman, and really to see, you know, what kind of hardship they've been going through in the past 3 years.
And you captured some very, just very stark scenes, and things that, I mean, it's amazing that you were able to catch while the camera was rolling. One thing that comes to mind is when Ying Ying's boyfriend comes across a dying bird in front of their old dormitory, and he buries it. Describe that moment for us.
For me, I mean, when I was filming, we were just walking, you know, in that place, and we heard something like hit the wall or the window, and we found out it was a bird. And Shaolin, Ying's boyfriend, he actually tried to comfort that bird, mm-hmm, and tried to save that bird at first. But later on, I think it's just after, I don't know how long, it just seemed that the bird is dead. And then he just started to digging the mud and also trying to, like, bury him. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think too much when I first, like, filming it. But later, when I was going through all the footage in post-production, that was such a powerful scene and really meaningful scene. Mm-hmm. We talked to Shaolin, and he said he just feel like, you know, at that moment, Ying Ying came back. And he wasn't able to, like, bury her, you know, in the real life. But burying the bird somehow feels like, you know, he's doing something for Yingying. Yeah. And also talking about the bird element, we actually kind of, you know, put different bird elements in the film. Mm-hmm. Like the film title, we put a little bird on Yingying, above Yingying. And also Yingying's like postcards where she's that, the postcard that she sent to her friends, sometimes she would like draw more icons and there was a bird. For us, it's like more like a metaphor.
Definitely. That's Jenny Xu, director of the award-winning film Finding Yingying. Jenny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can find more about the film at our website, statewideshow.com. That's all the time we have this week. We're glad you tuned in. You can join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's program or past shows, you can find them all at our website, statewideshow.com, and also follow us on Facebook, look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.